Well, I tell you what, some of those players, in fact, all those players aren't with us anymore, but I like the song anyway, and it gets us in the mood to talk baseball and a bit Brewers baseball. Today, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. A couple of guests for you today on the show from Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. One is Paul Noonan. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the other is Ryan Topp. And Ryan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks. Thrilled to be here.
They are the producers of the show. And as we talk with them about Brewers and about baseball in general, I hope you'll join in. What are your predictions for the Brewers season? What do you think about the injuries that are facing the team right now? And of course, we want to hear from you. So give us a call with your ideas, questions, suggestions. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Before we get started into what's going on with the Brewers, let's talk about Tailgate Brewers podcast. How'd you guys get that started? Paul, do you want to take that?
Ryan should go first because he's been on it much longer than I have.
Okay.
Yeah, so I started it back in 2017 with a couple of friends of mine, J.P. Breen and Steve Gershinsky, who still occasionally make guest appearances, but life started to kind of get in the way. But I decided to continue it on, and we brought in a new generation of hosts, and that's how we ended up with both Paul and our other host, co-host, James Langer. So that has been over the last, 5 years now. Basically, it almost perfectly coincided with COVID, actually. So we've been doing it for a long time, and we're up to, what was our 339th episode, I think, was what we recorded on Sunday night. So
I think that's right. And all of us are either audiophiles or sort of former baseball writers or current baseball writers to some extent. So just sort of a natural progression into doing the podcast for quite some time now.
Yeah, and I've listened, and you guys, you sound great, and it's a lot of fun to listen. You have some great banter back and forth, but also a lot of really good information about the Brewers and some good opinion, too, in my opinion. So, well, we'll mention Tailgate Brewers podcast more than once during the course of the show, but I watched the game last night with Colorado. And the Brewers in Colorado, and it was kind of an epic one. I don't know if you guys watched it or not, but I think it was, 9-8 next in the 10th inning, Brewers lost.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, it was a frustrating game last night. They've had a bad run in Colorado for a while now. That place is just a weird place to play with baseballs just flying out of the park very easily. It's a huge outfield, and it has not suited their strengths, which has sort of typically been pitching first over the years. So this isn't really suited their strength. They're a better offense this year, and it was nice that they kind of went toe-to-toe with them. But there was also some weirdness with the umpires. There was a strange call at first base that may have been right, but it was still a strange one you don't see very often. And so it was just a frustrating game all around.
Wound up getting Pat Murphy tossed from the game, which I thought was kind of a quick ejection there from the umpire. Of course, we couldn't hear what he was saying, but he seemed modest. He wasn't shouting and screaming at the top of his lungs, so I was surprised. I think the good part about last night's game was Willie Adames and William Contreras kind of broke out of their hitting slumps.
They did. Very nice to see, especially Willie Adames had been mired in that over 27 slump. And those are the two guys who just never take rest days. They've sort of insisted on playing every day. They definitely are trying to set an example for the team. But it has definitely taken a toll on both of them, especially offensively. So it's nice to see Willie actually get himself right, and hopefully it portends well going forward for the rest of the road trip.
Yeah, I'm hopeful because he is a very, very good catcher, a good hitting catcher, and probably, I think, one of the, if not the best catcher in the league right now in terms of batting, and pretty good catcher himself in terms of catching. He's certainly in the top two or three in the league.
Ryan, what do you think? I'd say top two.
Yeah, it's kind of him and Will Smith out in Los Angeles are the top two. And you could kind of put Sean Murphy into that, but he missed a good chunk of the first half of the season from Atlanta. So it's one of those guys. I think Contreras is probably going to start. We've sort of been joking on the show about don't vote for him for the All-Star game because, and this is just a joke, but because we want him to take a vacation.
Guy needs a day off.
Oh, man. Well, let's look at the team. You know, some of the players who are, you know, we just got through the Cubs series where they took the Cubs again, which was, and I want to get to a little more talk about the Cubs and the Brewers. But for those who are not watching the Brewers every day, like some of us are, it's such a young team. And it was hard for me even to remember names and who's playing where. Was that a problem for you guys at all? Probably not.
Well, definitely not for Ryan, who starts following people when they're like 15 years old. but I know that, like, I know the team up and down, but they will surprise me every once in a while, just especially on pitching. I feel like every once in a while they'll bring a guy into the game like, I've never heard of him before, or maybe I've like seen him down at AAA and they called him up. Last night was almost that with Rob Sestrinski. They do cycle through more players than just about any other team does. They are the pioneers of freely using their AAA team as a feeder system. And so that does happen. If you're not paying attention to the Brewers every day, they can definitely surprise you with just whoever they've called up from the night before to fill spots, especially with how injury plagued they've been.
Yeah. And there's been what, at least 14 starting pitchers this year the Brewers have used? 14.
I think Sestrinski was 13 last night. Lucky number 13.
Oh, it was 13? Oh.
Yeah, I think he was 13 last night. So they'll get to 14 soon enough, Larry. It's coming. And this has really just been a wild confluence of events. Some of those guys have been openers. They've used both Sestrinski and Koenig, who's now also hurt.
Yes.
And
Hobie Milner's got to start.
Yeah, Hobie Milner's got to start. So they've been using some openers where they're just planning to have that guy pitch one inning and then replace him with the guy who's actually really starting the game just an inning late. And that's a tactical thing. They tried it a little bit under Craig Counsell, former manager, but it never really worked well. And it's worked really well this year. They've had such success with it. I think Murphy's been sort of emboldened to just continue doing it. And it's been successful. So they've been happy to do that. It's really been sort of a really confounding year in terms of how this team has been. Both Paul and I, coming into the season, we didn't think that we were looking at a much above if 500 team. We both had them pegged right around 500. And so we're as surprised as anybody to see them doing what they're doing this year. It's really been something to watch.
Something especially like 14 games above 500 or thereabouts.
Yeah, they've been, frankly, dominant for their division. And I think the weirdest part for Ryan and I is we did peg their big issue correctly, which was depth at starting pitching, where they didn't have a lot to start. They were relying to get a lot of innings on Freddy Peralta and Wade Miley. Wade's been gone for a month now. And that worry happened, and they've been good in spite of it. It's almost as if their starting pitching just doesn't even matter. They've been able to grind through it and create them out of nowhere. And I don't know that anybody could have predicted that except maybe the Brewers themselves.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. Alyssa in Sparta, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Thank you. So my family of four and I went to the game on Sunday, and what an awesome experience that was. It was our first Brewers-Cubs game at the new field. We've been to the Wrigley Field for that experience before. And just two comments on the change to the pitching clock is really nice for us with young kids. It kind of just keeps the game moving swiftly. And then what an awesome, fun, and young team we have. It's just so much fun for them. And I think it's brought a lot of people to baseball.
Alyssa, thanks a lot for calling. Well, let's get some comments from Ryan. Maybe start with you, and then we go to Paul.
Yeah, I was also there on Sunday, and I had a very good time at that game, especially once the Cubs went behind and the people that were screaming in my ear stopped screaming in my ear. that was kind of nice. It really is. The pitch clock has been a godsend to me personally. As a person, I attend about 20 to 30 games. I've been a season seat holder since 2006. And to be able to go on weeknight games when I'm a teacher, so during the school year, I can go at some of these 6:40 starts and know that I'm going to be home by 9:30, as opposed to back when, where I didn't know I might get home at 11. And that just... I'm not as young as I used to be, and that was quite a grind. So having this pitch clock in and having about almost a solid half hour cut out of the game has been just unbelievable for the overall experience and the product. So I really appreciate that. And Paul, I'll let you talk about the exciting young players.
That's okay. It's great for families. Just want to tag onto that too. It's nice to be able to get your kids home and to bed at a decent hour. And it's really, we should talk about injuries later, but that game in particular, I think, was one of my favorites of the year because the Cubs pitcher in that game was Kyle Hendricks, a pitcher who has befuddled the Brewers for many, many years, who hasn't really been good against many other opponents for like 3 or 4 years now. He's very, very old. His stuff has diminished, and he just seems to have always had our number, and finally, we beat Kyle Hendricks into submission. Yelich had the 2-run shot. And Jackson Churio, who, if you're not a close follower of the Brewers like we are, you should know Jackson Churio is either the first or second best prospect in all of baseball. He is as well-regarded as they come. He tends to start slow when he's promoted a level, which he was this year, to Major League Baseball. And you're just starting to see him adjust and kick in now. And his grand slam as part of the big grand slam run was, I think, sort of a nice introduction to everybody that this is a guy that you should be paying attention to and keeping an eye on.
Yeah. Just to pick up with that too, he is probably the best Brewers prospect maybe since Robin Yount. You could also throw Gary Sheffield in there as a guy who is a top-notch prospect, but he's better than that great generation that they had come through in 2005 to 2007. Those guys were good prospects, but Churio is a true, you know, potential superstar. And what he's doing as a 20-year-old, he just turned 20 in March, and what he's doing as a 20-year-old, he's well ahead of what Robin Yount was doing as a 20-year-old in 1976. And that's pretty remarkable when you think about the undisputed greatest player in Brewers history, if you don't count Hank Aaron, because he was only with them for 2 years at the very end there.
Yep.
But yeah, Yount is the greatest player in Brewers history. And Churio is really ahead of that pace right now in terms of coming on. Yount didn't have his first really good season until he was 22. And Churio is kind of scraping to about average right now, which is really remarkable for a guy his age. You don't see that very much.
No, and he's going to be with us for a while. That was maybe one of the smartest things the Brewers have done, in my opinion.
Yeah, they gave him a 10-year contract that made him the highest-paid player ever who had not yet played in the big leagues. He's guaranteed $82 million over 8 years, but it can expand up to, I believe, about $140 over 10. If they choose to pick up those team options. And that's just, obviously, that's massive for the team to know that he's kind of locked in and he's going to be there for that amount of time and that they can just sort of take their time. And I think that was a big part of why they called him up right away. There was just no need to keep him down. And they said, we're going to let him go through these growing pains. And it was really interesting in the month of May, he did lose a little bit of playing time. And there was some griping. There was some discussion among Brewer fans about why wasn't he playing as much. And the Brewers were just trying to manage him and still get him into games fairly regularly, but also just give him time to sort of develop and mature and figure out what he needed to do at the plate. And we've seen that since the month of June started. He has been one of the best hitters on the team. So he's been absolutely incredible in the month of June. And so that is their management of him turns out to have been just absolutely pitch perfect on this.
Yeah. I did get my grand slams mixed up, by the way. Sunday was one of Bryce Turang's 2 grand slams over the last 6 days, not Churio's. So
five, it's, Five Grand Slams in eight games. After the beginning of the season, it didn't seem like we could ever hit one.
Yep, regression to the mean came calling hard there. I think one of the weirdest things about that streak is Terang has two of them. He is not known for his power at all. In fact, he barely ever pulls the ball. One of those was an other way shot, but he did pull one out. When things are rolling. And Terang, if he can, you know, step into a couple home runs every year and hit like 10-ish or maybe a little more than that, with his speed and with his bat control, he's also going to be one of the best young players in baseball / on the team. He's actually WAR is kind of an all-encompassing baseball stat that tells you basically how good somebody is compared to the rest of the league. And by Baseball Reference WAR, there's three WARs. Terang's currently the fifth most valuable player in all of baseball. So, having a dynamite season.
Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. Great to have them with us. And Mark and Bloomer, we'll get to you in just a minute, but a reminder, you can join in too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking Brewers baseball with Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along. Join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Mark and Bloomer, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
So I remember being in middle school with Robin Yount, Paul Molitor, Raleigh Fingers, Pete Vukovich. And I remember when we were last in the big game, it was something that you just don't forget. As a little kid, that was pretty impressionable. And I'm wondering if this is the year. Are we going back?
Are we going back, Ryan?
That's a hard one. I hope so. It's very hard in this era of baseball when there's so many layers of playoffs. Back when the Brewers went to the World Series in 82, there was just the championship series and then the World Series. You had to make it through two layers of playoffs. Nowadays, you either have to make it through three or possibly four, depending on where you finish. And so baseball is sort of notoriously random in the postseason. The best team very often does not win those series. And so even when you're the better team, you don't necessarily win. Last year, there's no earthly reason that the Brewers were beaten by the Diamondbacks. The Diamondbacks weren't better than the Brewers. It's just that in those couple of games, they happened to get the things to break their way. So they ended up advancing. And so it's a really tough one. I certainly hope so. I would love to see them to go and make a run. 2011, 2018 were a lot of fun, winning those playoff series and, you know, advancing deep into the NLCS. Enjoyed it a lot, but you never know because it's baseball and you just notoriously can't predict ball.
Yeah, baseball has taken the same tact as a lot of American sports to try and make the playoffs more exciting, but in doing so, they've sort of punished the actual good teams versus the teams that skate in. The one thing I'll say about this iteration of the Brewers is there's a lot of underlying metrics that really speak to them being a better team than they have been in a lot of other recent years. A lot of times in the late council era, they've kind of been a little bit smoke and mirrors of really leaning on their bullpen to win close games and not really outscoring their opponents in the aggregate. And you'd kind of look for that to see the good versus the not so good. This is an actual, so far, kind of juggernaut that can hang with the Dodgers and the Phillies, which has not been the case recently. So doesn't mean that they'll win in the playoffs, but they're better equipped than they have been recently. Big worry there for me, though, is still just starting pitching. Like, if Tobias Myers is starting a playoff game for me, I'm not sure how I feel about that. He's been fantastic, but, it's like having, like, your seventh best starter starting a playoff game, and right now that's what would probably be happening at some point.
Yeah, it's and then I think about people like Jared Koenig, who has just been lights out. Now he's hurt.
Yeah, there was good news on that. They said that the imaging came back and he was not actually there's no tear. There's nothing like that. There's swelling and they're waiting for the swelling to go down. So With that injury in particular, it is sometimes a harbinger of Tommy John surgery, and then the guys go on for a year and a half at that point. And that doesn't seem to be the case at this point with Jared Koenig. So they may have dodged a bit of a bullet there, but he's getting some rest and recuperation right now, and hopefully we'll be back after the All-Star break.
Well, rest for sure. I mean, talk about being used a lot. He was used an awful lot.
Yeah, I mean, the Brewers do this more than anybody else, too. They have very short leashes for their starters. The only recent exceptions were Corbin Burnes and Brandon Woodruff when they were still on the team. But aside from those two, the Brewers have the quickest hook in baseball and have for quite a while, and really lean on their middle relief to kind of an absurd extent. And Jared Koenig, of course, ended up starting quite a bit down the stretch, but he has been that guy. And they have one or two of those every year, and it's honestly a difficult position to be in. If you're doing that for the Brewers, you're kind of making a little bit of a Faustian bargain with yourself, because Jared Koenig is kind of he's a 30-year-old guy. He's basically been a non-prospect for a while, and he gets this opportunity with the Brewers, with their pitching lab, to pitch the most thankless part of the game, the middle relief where you don't get the saves, under their tutelage, and those guys do tend to get hurt a lot. So he's been fantastic. He's been absolutely essential to the team. But the guy in that role doesn't tend to be long for this world. So I hope he rallies back, and I hope he can get through the rest of the season. But it is a grueling role to have in the bullpen.
Yeah, it is indeed. Paula in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling, Paula.
Oh, hi. Well, I wanted to do a shout-out just for the Brewers organization. Last Wednesday, we were at the game, and it was a great game. They came back and won, the Texas Rangers. But we took my almost 94-year-old dad, and not only do you get they have the senior days. My husband and I are also seniors, and we got the half-price tickets. But just a huge shout-out to their guest services that provide wonderful service for people that need assistance with a wheelchair to get to their seat, and also with a golf cart to bring people in from the parking lot. They just really do a fantastic job to get people at the ballpark, especially our older people and young ones.
Oh, Paula, thanks a lot. Comment on that? Ryan, maybe first?
Yeah, I was also there on Wednesday, and that was lacrosse day. They, I guess, had 19 buses of people coming down from La Crosse. We were talking to one of the people. My wife is from La Crosse, so we connected with somebody on the concourse, and we're talking to them before the game. And that was really a wonderful day, a wonderful experience also at the park. And yeah, I have noticed they do a very good job with those sorts of things. You always see those courtesy shuttles rolling around the parking lots, bringing people up to the thing, because some of those walks can be quite a good distance, which is good for those of us that need to get out and do the walking and do that. We like to park far away, so we have to force ourselves to walk, but not everybody can do that. So yeah, it's wonderful. And the Brewers have been very accommodating on things like that.
By the way, your podcast is titled Tailgate Brewers. Have you guys tailgate at all this year or at any times?
Every once in a while, but I actually much prefer to take a bar shuttle there. I'll tailgate with my kids. So if I have them in tow, yes. But if it's just me and friends, I much prefer the easy in and outs of a couple of the local tavern shuttles around Milwaukee. And I actually live in Chicago, so I go to Wrigley a lot more than I do to American Family at this point. But no tailgating there.
Well, I use those shuttles too. Ryan, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I haven't tailgated this year, but we'll be doing it a little bit later this summer. My wife has a work outing every year that we do that. We also utilize the bar shuttles a lot and just park out in the neighborhood sometimes and then walk in. That's pretty common for us as well. So like to get those steps in.
Frank in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, emailed us actually a bunch of questions, but here's one. Pat Murphy, is Pat Murphy the second coming of Harvey Keene?
I think it may be fair to say he's the second coming of Craig Counsell. And I think one of the big lessons that we've learned from seeing Craig move on to the Cubs and how Pat Murphy runs things is that tactically, the Brewer front office actually has a huge impact in how the game is managed. In making the Pat Murphy is an old school baseball guy, but the Brewers continue to make almost always the correct tactical decision under him. And I think it's pretty clear that the educational process the Brewers run with their managers and the information they feed them is very, very useful. Pat Murphy, being an old school baseball guy, you get the best of both worlds here because you get a good motivator, you get a guy who will get ejected immediately, gets his point across pretty quickly, and also like a good disciplinarian. I think he's very good at understanding his players. He's handled his young players exceptionally well, Jackson Churio included. And really, the best manager in baseball is whoever the Brewers have at the moment, who is open to feedback from the higher ups on the team, but also a good people person and a good sort of commander in chief of the team, which Pat Murphy is.
Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of the front office's show. I think we've seen that. And it was processes that were put in place by former general manager and vice president of baseball operations, David Stearns, but have continued right with Matt Arnold over the last year and a half now, since Matt Arnold took his spot. They seem to be sort of directing traffic, but also leaving room for the managers to do the managing. And that's one of the hardest things to do. If you're a fan of the movie, or you should really read the book, Moneyball, you know that there sometimes gets to be conflict between these more sabermetrically inclined, these more analytically inclined front offices and their managers. And that can sometimes run into problems. And the Brewers seem to have managed to do this very, very well, where they're not running into those problems. And I think it's a credit to everybody involved in the front office, in the coach's box. All of these people seem to be handling it very, very well. And you get not even like whiffs of dissension over the years. It's been very rare when we've talked and chronicled something where there seemed to be a disagreement. There was maybe a little disagreement over some player usage last summer, but that stood out because it was just so rare. And we've just normally we've gotten used to seeing a very seamless sort of tag team work between the coaching staff and the front office. And that's been a big part of why the Brewers have been so successful. They're in this run now where they have been either in the playoffs or just barely missing it every year since 2017. I think they've only played in that time a couple of games, two or three games, that did not potentially impact a playoff spot, because they were eliminated in 17 very late and they were eliminated in 22 very late. Other than that, they've been in the playoffs every year. And that's been really something to watch.
I think there's been some good team leadership as well. And I'm thinking back to, I was watching the game on TV, Jackson Churio. There was a ball hit to right field and he kind of let it bounce in front of him. And then we saw a shot of Willie Adames. It looked like he was saying, hey, go after that ball.
We just talked about this on our podcast, actually, for two reasons. One of which is Willie Adames is definitely the leader in the clubhouse and one of the best leaders the team has had in forever. He is always there to rally people. And in that instance, I think telling Jackson Churio, like, hey, you're in the big leagues. You can take a chance there. If you make a mistake, you know, we'll still support you, but we'd rather have you laying out for that ball, which would have won them the game had he caught it, versus playing a conservative. And Willie has, I think, an excellent touch with everybody on the team, is very well respected, and really good at getting guys back up. The other reason we talked about that play, though, is Jackson Churio, as a young 20-year-old, 19-year-old at the start of the season, he was making mistakes like that. He wasn't, like, overmatched by pitching. He wasn't struggling to play the game the correct way. Everything just seemed sort of nerves for him. Like he was worried about doing the wrong thing. And in that instance, I think Willie's influence and calming presence and, just rah-rah to some extent is exactly what guys like Churio need to know, like, yeah, this is the bigs. You go all out there and we got your back if you mess up. That's how young guys come along and develop and get confidence that they can make all those plays. So I think that is secretly one of the bigger plays of the year. Churio, I think, had a notable start to turn around at that point. So Adames is crucial to the team and will be very expensive shortly. And that's going to be unfortunate because his bat's good, his glove is good, but his clubhouse presence is very good.
Yeah, you're right about that. Thinking about the team and how it's put together this year. You know, we losing Corbin Burns, you know, it felt, oh, no. But, you know, we wind up with some pretty good players. Joey Ortiz at third base is an example. Maybe just talk about how the team is, you know, we have some homegrown product in there. But, well, Ryan, you want to visit about how the team's put together?
Yeah, they really sort of utilize every aspect of being able to acquire players. They're working the trade market all the time. Obviously, Joey Ortiz and DL Hall, those guys came over in the Corbin Burns trade, and Ortiz has been incredible, just an absolute revelation for them. They also went out this winter and signed Rhys Hoskins to one of the larger free agent contracts they've signed in a while. So that was a utilization of that market. They also just work the sort of the under the radar guys, Jared Koenig and Brian Hudson. Hudson was actually a trade, but he was traded from the Dodgers under duress because they had to DFA him because they signed one of their, you know, $300 million pitchers that they get. So they had to DFA Hudson, and so they sent him to us, and he's been incredible for the Brewers as well. And then obviously we've talked about guys like Churio, who's homegrown, Sal Frelick, Bryce Terang. These guys were either draft picks or signed on the international market. And so they really utilize all these ways. And what we're in right now is what you could kind of define as the player optimization era. And what the deal is now, the really good teams like the Brewers, and they've been one of the gold standards at this, is it's not just about finding players who are underrated and have underrated skill sets the way Moneyball sort of 1.0 was. This is now about taking the players that you have and making them as good as they possibly can be, maximizing their potential and turning them into the best version of themselves. And the Brewers excel at this. This is one of the things they do absolutely incredibly. And it's been sort of a hallmark of this last, you know, decade of Brewers sort of dominance in the NL Central and being really, really good, is they just excel at turning players into the best versions of themselves. And like the most notable thing about that, as Paul kind of mentioned earlier, is the pitching lab. They have a pitching lab, and a lot of teams have pitching labs, but they really seem to know how to turn pitchers into the best possible version of themselves. And that's just absolutely tremendously valuable for a team that is never going to go out and spend toe-to-toe with the Yankees, the Dodgers, even the Cubs, teams like that. They're never going to spend toe-to-toe with them. Not in baseball. That's not how it works. But what they can do is turn the players that they have into the best version of what they can be.
Yeah, I think it was great that they hung on to the coaches when Craig Counsell left. And those coaches are worth gold.
That they are. They also have a very good integration system. Their pitching staff is outstanding, especially their bullpen. But one of the things they do that helps their pitching staff out also is they take a lot of guys with high floors on offense, and if they turn into good hitters, that's great. But what I mean by high floor is almost every regular on the team is an elite or near elite defensive player. Rhys Hoskins would be the exception to that rule. He is not good at defense, but like Blake Perkins is kind of just a guy, almost an afterthought coming into the season, but secretly one of the best center fielders in all of baseball. If you get any offense out of Blake Perkins, he's immediately one of the more valuable players in baseball. And his offense is okay. It's not great, but it's good enough to man center field. But all of those good defensive players, from Adames to Terang, who is outstanding at second base, to Joey Ortiz, who's very good at third base, means that if your pitching staff just can keep the ball in the park, even if they're not striking guys out as much as other teams' pitchers do, you're still going to have good run prevention. And so the Brewers get a bigger pool of available pitchers because of how their defense can play behind them. They're really, really good at sort of melding the entire team into a really logical whole in that way.
Yeah, I was thinking about it as a young player. It would be an attractive place to really go and play, wouldn't it?
Ryan,
I mean, you're going to make you have a chance to become even better under the kind of system and coaching that they get.
Yeah, and I think pitchers have sort of started to identify that and have started to seek the Brewers out, especially guys who are maybe they don't have much else where to go. There's not really a path for them. And we've started to see them seeking out places to come here. And the relationship, say, between Wade Miley, who's been off and on a Brewer since 2018, he's gone and he's come back. But he has really been sort of the ultimate totem of this idea that he is a pitcher who had kind of fallen on hard times. His career was sputtering and sort of going nowhere. He came to the Brewers and they showed him how you can be the best version of what you can do. And there are some guys on this team. Paul mentioned the integration of this. They have, you know, obviously they have this front office staff, people that do really good analytical work down to very granular levels now, but they also have people in the dugout. I just want to point out, like, Walker McKinven is a guy that doesn't get talked about much, but McKinven is what they call their run prevention coordinator, and he sort of manages the where the defense and the pitching staff work together to make sure that the pitching staff and the defense are on the same page, that we're going to put baseballs in places that are going to be where the fielders are going to be able to field them. And they really worry about the details on that stuff on such a level. And it was wonderful. You pointed out, Larry, that they brought all those coaches back, and that was a very smart thing. It'll be interesting to see if the team to the south comes poaching a bunch of those guys this winter and offering them huge big raises to come down and play and work for them, because they obviously have, you know, financial resources that just well outstrip what the Brewers have. We'll see how that works out this winter, but they just seem to have a really good idea of an integrated whole for their system.
Talking Brewers baseball today with our guests Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, who are hosts of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking Brewers baseball now with our two guests, Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan from Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. Great to have them on. And if you have a question or comment, maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Some emails I want to get through here. Oh, KJM emailed us to correct you, Ryan. I had said 14 Brewer pitchers have had at least one start. You said, no, it was 13, but KJM says baseballreference.com lists 15 Brewers who have had at least one start this season. So it's an amazing number, considering there are, 13 pitchers on the team, something like that. They come and they go. They're up and they're down. Jeff commented, the Brewers are 14th in attendance this year despite being the smallest market team. That good in your mind, Paul?
That's excellent. And I was just going over to reference to double check that, and that is correct. I don't know why we had 13. I wonder if we missed maybe Keuchel's start in there. But
I think we did.
Yeah, okay. Milwaukee has always been a great baseball town and have always well outperformed their market in terms of attendance. I feel like Milwaukeeans generally just like any excuse to have a party at a given moment, and baseball games are good for that. Get to be outside, get to be in the parking lot. It's an event every day. And I've lived in a lot of places now. Not everybody's like that. So they will fill up the stadium far better than anybody of comparable size. And I'm not surprised. I'm actually surprised their attendance isn't a little higher, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a good season, so it does drive that. And they fill the place up. They always have.
Another one, will Garrett Mitchell contribute to the team? And I think last night he drove in around. It was his first at-bat in a while, I believe.
Yeah, he had missed the beginning of the season. He had a broken hand issue in spring training right at the very end, and he's been hurt a lot. That's really been, more than anything, the story of Garrett Mitchell's career. He's a type 1 diabetic, and that was kind of an issue, maybe pushed his draft stock down when the Brewers drafted him and were able to get him in the 2020 draft. So he did come out, and there's a lot of excitement around Garrett Mitchell because he has some obviously just wonderful tools. He's blazingly fast, a great fielder in center field, and has some power that he can tap into if he can get his swing right and do that. And his minor league career often was not him being able to do that. He also strikes out a lot. So it's an interesting balance that you have to try to strike with Garrett Mitchell, but he's among the intriguing young players that the Brewers have, and something that we're definitely interested to see where this goes, because it could go a lot of different directions with Garrett Mitchell. There's definitely talent there, but there's a lot of downsides too.
Yeah. And he was just starting to turn it around last year when he got hurt the first time in the bigs, but we need an extended look at him because Ryan is right. The strikeouts are concerning with him. And it's one of those, if he can get that right into a manageable level, he has as much upside as anybody on the team. But if he can't stay healthy, it doesn't matter. Like, that's skill number one for Garrett Mitchell, is he's just got to play a season at some point without enduring some kind of injury.
You know, speaking of injuries, The Athletic had a nice piece about pitchers and the concept of pitching and the speed with which they're having to pitch these days. I mean, you know, Warren Spahn, one game, pitched 16 innings for the Milwaukee Braves against Juan Marichal, who beat him 1-0. And Marichal pitched the 16 innings as well. But now, Freddy Peralta, what is he in? 4 or 5 innings maybe. And he's a long inning pitcher for us. But guys are throwing so hard, and I think they're being asked to throw so hard. You want to comment on strikeouts are up.
There's a lot going into that. And so it is definitely true. Pitchers just don't pitch as much as they used to. And a lot of that is just, they're going max effort all the time. In the early days of baseball, really up through the 80s, kind of into the steroid era, pitching was an entirely different game where guys wouldn't go all out, especially starters, for the whole game. There would be random holes in opposing lineups, especially at shortstop, at catcher, at second base, where you wouldn't have guys with as much pop, where pitchers can kind of take off for a couple of at-bats per nine and not show their best stuff and save their arms a little bit. And that era is over. Like, shortstop is now one of the biggest hitting positions in baseball. Shortstops are often, Willie Adames is one of the best hitters on the Brewers. He's one of the most fearsome. He's their shortstop. Catchers are not just guys to sit back there. Like, Bob Uecker era is over. Like, catchers also can hit. So there are no easy outs in baseball, and that has led to pitchers who have to be on all the time, but also are pressured, not pressured by people, but pressured by staying in the game to throw as hard as they can all the time, because if they get hit around, they won't be in baseball. Somebody else will step in and be willing to throw hard all the time. And that has definitely led to an increase in injuries, without question. Injuries have come up a lot, but it's not just everybody throwing harder either. It's also that our medical technology has gotten so much better that guys who would have gotten hurt pitching in the 80s and 70s and 60s now make it through to the big leagues. Guys who would sort of be pre-selected to never play in baseball because their arms would fall off from throwing too hard, we're now good at nursing those guys along and making sure they do stick together for as long as possible. So we have this combination of guys throwing harder than ever, of guys who would have gotten hurt previously sticking around longer than ever, and that's what has caused sort of the pitching carousel that we see these days in baseball.
And I'm wondering what your thoughts are. Earlier, we talked about the pitch clock a little bit, but I wonder if that doesn't enter into the whole mix.
It might. There's some emerging research on that. It's very early in the game to be able to get really good numbers on that sort of thing. You're going to need a lot longer sample size to be able to do that. I'm pretty skeptical that that's the thing. I think it's much more explained. Justin Verlander really explained this. He's a Hall of Fame, will be a Hall of Fame pitcher once he retires and waits his 5 years. And he talked about this, that in the first half of his career, he came up in around 2006, he didn't used to throw at the top end of his velocity very much at all. He just didn't do it. And that would leave him like being able to pace himself and go deeper into games. Sandy Koufax talked about this too, that this was how he did it. And Verlander said in 2015, which was the first year, 2015 and 19, we can kind of call the rabbit ball era, which is where baseball was using some balls that were really flying out of the park. And that put so much pressure on pitchers, and it's really continued now with this whole player optimization era, where guys are all capable of hitting home runs, like Paul said. And I think that's really the bigger explanation here for what's going on. The pitch clock might have some small role to play in it, but guys like Verlander have said, I never had arm problems until I started throwing at the top end of my range every pitch, because I knew that anybody who I faced could hit one out on me. And so I needed to be on top of my game at every moment. And that just wasn't the way that it was when he was a younger pitcher. So
I'm a little less skeptical than Ryan. I've seen some papers early on that do seem to indicate that the pitch clock has had an adverse effect on health for pitchers. The mechanisms for that are still sort of not well defined, but I wouldn't be that surprised, only because kind of like hitters who you see like adjust their gloves between every at bat and whatnot. Pitchers, if they're not comfortable pitching, are going to have little tiny tendencies that they change from pitch to pitch that they otherwise wouldn't have. And hurrying them along, I don't think it's really a recovery thing. I think a lot of guys get to the end of the clock and they're like, I have to pitch now, and I'm not quite set. And it messes with their mechanics a little bit. So I do think there is a little bit of it. I think it's very possible there is some negatives to the pitch clock. And it'll be interesting to see how the pitchers, especially as members of the union, deal with that going forward, too, if it turns out to be the case.
What do you guys, we haven't talked about AI at all, and here we've got talk about a robo-ump system, which is, in fact, being used in the minors, giving the final say on what's a ball, what's a strike, taking that away from the home plate umpire. What do you think?
Yeah, so that is coming to Big League Baseball. It's a question of when. There was just something recently. Commissioner Rob Manfred said they weren't going to be ready to launch in 2025. People had been sort of pointing to 2025. But one thing they did recently do, they had been splitting time between a fully automated zone on some days of the week and then a challenge system on other days of the week. And so some days you would get every single call being made by these robo umps, and then other days it was just a question of challenging. And then it looked kind of like tennis, where a player could point and say, hey, I want a review of this, and it would pop up on the scoreboard, and it happens in about 10 seconds. So it's very quick and isn't too laborious a process. Baseball did announce just last couple weeks that one, when they do go to this, they're going to go to the challenge system, because the players, the fans, the coaches, everybody seems to prefer the challenge system to a fully automated zone. The fully automated zone has not been as popular as the challenge system, but it's probably not coming in 2025, according to Manfred. They're going to have to wait a little bit. There's still some technological gremlins, apparently, to work out with the thing and make sure that it's ready for prime time, because a blown call in a big league game is a lot different than a blown call in a minor league game. So they have to get it ironed out at this point.
Yeah.
And then we've got what is it called? The pitching machine that is a high tech that'll mimic the way balls break from every major league pitcher. You know what? That's going to have to be a topic for another conversation with. And I hope you guys will be back. It was a lot of fun today talking with you, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Thanks so much.
Happy to do so. Thank you very much for having us.
Oh, man, it was fun talking with our guests, Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan. They have a great podcast. It's called Tailgate Brewers, Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, and they will hopefully we'll get them back and we can talk Brewers baseball with them again. In the meantime, take a look at that podcast. I think you'll be interested and enjoy it. Coming up, we're going to be talking about UW women's rowing, and we'll talk with the women's rowing coach, Vicki Opitz. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking baseball. Raleigh, Raleigh, Raleigh. Well, fingers the name. Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. We're going to take a look at rowing. You know, rowing originally served as a way of transportation, actually, for ancient civilizations. Became a sport at the end of the 17th century. And here we are in 2024, and we're going to be talking about women's rowing today with Badger head coach Vicki Opitz. Vicki herself is a world champion, a Big Ten champion, All-American. She's been to the Olympics, and we'll also talk about the four Wisconsin rowing alums who are competing at the coming Olympic Games in just almost exactly a month, I think. And as we talk with Vicki, I hope you will join in. Are you a rower? Have you been part of crew at Wisconsin or somewhere else? What do you love about the sport? What questions do you have about the sport? The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. Vicki Opitz, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Larry, thank you so much for having me on, and on behalf of Wisconsin Women's Rowing, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I've had lots of good experiences when it comes to UW sports, and particularly with rowing, so I'm glad to have you here. There's going to be a spotlight on rowing during the year's Olympics. And, you know, for some people, a lot of people have never watched a regatta, seen people row. Why should people consider tuning into rowing here for the Olympics?
That is a fantastic question. Rowing, in my opinion, is probably one of the most beautiful but also fiercest, like, you know, events you can watch. And the ironic thing is, if it looks beautiful, that means it is going really well, and it means that the rower is going so hard. Like, if it looks effortless, that means they're doing it correctly. But if you could, you know, if there was a way to look inside a rower's brain when they're racing, it would be absolute chaos of discomfort. So it's a very odd sport that it looks beautiful, but the pain cave, as we like to call it, is deep.
Yeah, and it's, to me, it's exciting to watch, mm-hmm. to be perfectly honest.
Absolutely.
And I like watching it in person, but yeah, I think TV does a pretty fair mm-hmm. job with it.
They've definitely gotten better, especially with the amount of drone coverage that started to be incorporated into our sport. Yeah. Allows it, you know, to get those close-ups and to really follow the racing. It definitely makes it more exciting.
So let's talk about the Badgers. The Badgers have a little history. Maybe give us a little history about, I mean, we started in what, 1874?
Oh, yes. It is actually the oldest sport on campus here at Wisconsin. It has a very long history. Our men's team this coming fall will be celebrating 150 years of men's rowing, which is, you know, and in itself an amazing accomplishment, let alone the amount of alumni that have gone on to do, you know, tremendous things, not only as rower athletes, but also, you know, out in the professional world has been extraordinary. And, you know, on the women's side of things, we just celebrated 50 years with Title IX 2 years ago. And I believe our lightweight team will be celebrating, I think, 35 years of lightweight women's rowing. So we have tremendous amount of history and alumni that have been through our doors.
Yeah. And how many women are rowing now for UW?
Great question. So it does tend to fluctuate given the year, but our roster size at the beginning of this year, between our varsity open weight women, our freshman novice team, and our lightweight team, was 140 athletes. So it's a football team in its own sense.
I was going to say it's about the size of in terms of numbers of the football team. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people involved here, not only here but at campuses across the mm-hmm. country. Well, we have let's think about the Olympics for a minute. Prior to the Olympics, Wisconsin women's rowers have gone to compete at the Olympics. I think it's 43, something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes. A lot of Olympian Badgers, and a lot of them were walk-ons to the sport, new to the sport in college.
So I think there are 37 Badgers who have earned 43 total All-American honors.
Yes.
What's the secret to the success here? I mean, this has been a really successful program.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I have to give credit to my predecessors. I think there's been a lot of really good, you know, coaches that have been at Wisconsin. I think there's been a lot of good administration that's helped support, you know, all of, you know, it takes a village to create a successful program. So that's been really beneficial. And I think there's something, in all honesty, about, you know, maybe it's our environment, the type of athletes that, you know, come to Wisconsin. You have to be really courageous and strong and determined to do our winter training when you're landlocked for a while with the ice. So I think it really, you know, celebrates and honors a type of athlete that is just very strong and wants to be the best in all they can do.
Who, and we have four going to the Olympics this
year.
Who have we got?
We got Sophia Vitas, Maddie Wanamaker, Lauren O'Connor, and Grace Joyce.
And they are graduated.
Correct. They all have graduated within the last, I want to say if I'm getting my math right, 7 to 4 years. And Sophia Vitas will be in the women's double. So that's a two-person boat with two oars per athlete. Maddie Wanamaker will be in the women's eight, and that's one oar. So that's a sweep boat. And then both Lauren and Grace will be representing the women's quad, and that's a four-person boat with two oars in each hand.
I'm wondering about, you mentioned novices. How do you form your teams?
That's a great question. We have a very strong history of walk-ons or novice culture. You know, typically, I think it's a pretty similar process that's still goes on that was, you know, kind of initiated in the 70s is we do go to SOAR. We look at, you know, men and women that, you know, have the physicality to be very good rowing athletes. And we are, you know, allowed to go talk to them during that process and just kind of approach them and be, hey, have you ever thought about being a Division I athlete?
and they say what?
we do get a couple of wide eyes, like, what are you talking about? But you know, so often we get these, you know, very talented three sport athletes that maybe weren't quite good enough to, you know, be recruited for their sport in college, but or you get the, you know, the students that come to Madison that wanted to always go to Madison, you know, regardless of their sport. But it's such an opportunity to, you know, make friends right away. You get tremendous, you know, support from the athletic department. It's a great way to, you know, if you make a competitive traveling squad to see the country and to compete against other, you know, like-minded individuals. It's very, very fun.
You know, we had a when my daughter was very small, we had a gal come and babysit, and just, she mentioned in passing that, and she was a high school kid, but she was on a rowing, in a rowing club, and she was really hoping that down the road she'd be able to land a spot on the crew. Is there much of that?
Oh, yes. I would say even in the last 10 years, the competitive level of our sport has gone through the roof. I mean, you have programs around the country that are recruiting top-tier athletes, and even at the youth level, like the whole community and culture has just exploded. It's awesome for our sport, and you know, at the collegiate level, we get very excited because you have these, you know, youngsters that started off earlier in their career and have developed a little bit more than say our walk-ons initially.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's an exciting and sometimes challenging balance, you know, working with our athletes that have those fundamental skills, know a little bit more about the sport than our walk-ons, but watching sometimes our walk-ons overtake them in terms of power and finesse. So it's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It reminded me when you talked about the walk-ons taking over. I was thinking to the back to the movie The Boys in the Boat, which I loved a lot. Did that and the book, which you I think say and most everybody I've talked to says the book's even better than the movie. But I really enjoyed the movie. Did that make any difference at all in interest? The book itself or the movie, did it have any impact on the interest among young men or women who wanted to hey, maybe I could try that out.
I think so. I think it'll be really interesting to see this coming fall because the movie came out, I believe, you know, around the holidays this past year. So I think it'll be interesting to see this fall how that plays out. But certainly, you know, the book's release, just having that dialogue out in, you know, the non-rower community. I have had, you know, a lot of people, you know, if I'm wearing a shirt around town that says rowing, be like, oh, rowing, boys in the boat. I've read the book. And it's I think it's fantastic that it's just even a dialogue that people want to engage in and talk about.
When in terms of novice, when you train or how do you train novice rowers and bring them up to speed in order to compete?
Another great question. So you do it very methodically. You start with the basics pretty right out of the gates. While the rowing motion itself is not overtly complicated, there's a lot of variables. So you are in a boat with other athletes. So how they move their body through space can affect how you move your body through space. You are out there in the elements on the water. We do not always race on beautiful flat water days.
Yeah.
Often you get a lot of wind, a lot of, you know, bumps. So just learning how to be precise in a lot of variable conditions makes it challenging. But also that's what makes our sport, you know, really fascinating is how consistent can you be again and again and again.
Well, if there are eight people in the boat, everybody's got.
Oh, yeah. You got to get everybody at least pretty close to moving together.
I'm always amazed watching. We lived on Lake Monona, and so there was some practicing in the morning sometimes on Lake Monona. And it seems like they're just kind of moving along. But then when you see the coaches who are in the motorboat going along, they're going pretty fast.
Yes.
How fast do they? How fast does a crew boat? Get do you
Ooh,
think?
All right. That's a great question. You're putting me on the spot. I want to say, like, at the elite level, I know, like, a women's eight can get up to, like, 20 kilometers an hour, if I'm remembering that correctly. It can go quite fast.
That's fast.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, man. So what's a training schedule like?
Mm-hmm. For, you know, I would say a pretty typical college athlete, or at least here at Wisconsin, depending on which squad you are on, we practice in the morning session, and that's usually, you know, around 6 to 8 in the morning, a water session. And then in the afternoons, we either have another water session or some cross training, you know, going for runs, running stadiums, which I think a lot of our alumni will appreciate the shout out on that. Stationary biking has become a really good form of cross training.
Yeah.
And a lot of lifting. Rowing is a beautiful balance of power and cardio, so you need to be good at both.
And the other good thing about it's low impact.
Yes. Yes.
So you're not pounding your
No. feet on and the that's ground. What's tremendous about the sport too is there's been a lot of I would say older individuals that have kind of come to the sport in the masters category, and you know, people that didn't do it as youths, didn't do it in college, but have just sort of gravitated to it, you know, maybe a lot of times post retirement and just fall in love with the sport.
Actually, Marty and DePere emailed us and said, "Are there rowing races for people who are just interested in trying things out and maybe over the age of 60?"
Absolutely! Oh, I'm so excited to like have someone ask that. Yes, absolutely. I would highly recommend reaching out to, you know, your local club, depending on where you live, or you know, I'm quite sure here in Madison, our local clubs do Learn to Row Days, which encourages people of all ages to come and try out, you know, what is this rowing thing. And if you really get passionate about it, there is Masters Worlds where you can also go travel the country and the world and compete as a master over 60.
Our guest today, Vicki Opitz, is head coach at the UW-Madison's women rowing team. We're talking about the sport of rowing. We're taking a look at the Olympics and certainly inviting you to join in with your questions or comments. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks a lot for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are talking with Vicki Opitz right now. Vicki is the head coach of the UW-Madison women's rowing team. And we're talking about rowing. We're looking at the Olympics and certainly taking your questions or comments as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Glenn in Fox Lake. Glenn, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. What I did for many years is I row trolled in northern Wisconsin in a 15-foot Grumman sport boat for muskies.
Oh, you're a good man.
I set up a footrest, and then I had three rod holders that were on the footrest. And when I got tired of rowing, I just had my – the boat was quite stable, and I had my life jacket on, and I'd cast.
And you got a lot out of that rowing, I bet, physically.
I did. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well – Do you ever get any gals who were involved in rowing that way and got them started?
Actually, funny enough, out on the East Coast, a lot of lifeguards, they kind of compete in these like oceanic competitions, which kind of harken back to when they had to go rescue people with lifeboats. And it's funny, there's this addition to our sport, which is called coastal rowing. And that's where it's out on the ocean, and it's, similar motions, slightly different boats. They are quite heavy. They're usually a four-person boat is 300 pounds. And it's a mass start, and it's either a long trek that takes about 25 minutes to do this race, or it's a beach sprint where you have to start out of the boat, jump into the boat, do a course, jump out, and then run back on land. So our sport's evolving, and it sounds like this gentleman's already, tasted a little bit of that heavy boat training. So good on him.
Glenn, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Becca emailed us. She wonders, what advancements have been made in boats used for rowing and the paddles? How heavy are these boats, and what are they like for people who've never seen one before? They have to be pretty different from a recreational canoe.
Yes. Oh, yes. No, that's a great question. So the boats have definitely evolved quite a bit over time. In Porter Boathouse here on campus, we have one of the older original boats suspended from our ceiling, which was made out of wood, very heavy bolts and nuts holding it together, which I look at it and I can't even imagine lifting that, today. But most of our boats now are made up out of carbon fiber. So they are extremely lightweight, but also the flip side of that is extremely fragile. So if you don't step in a boat correctly, you can actually step through the boat. Shout out to our amazing boatmen that we have on our campus too, that they can fix anything, and they are artisans in their craft of repairing boats. So we're very lucky to have them.
And the paddles?
Those too, it's interesting. That's kind of a constant change in our sport. The blade shape has changed over the years. It used to be a very long, they called it a tulip shape. And then there's everything now from kind of, there's like a convex flat blade to there's like C cups. I mean, you name it. There's like slightly different shapes that are supposed to complement, certain rowing styles or even the size of the athlete. But those are also made out of plastic. They are no longer made out of wood, so they are also quite a bit lighter than the original pieces of equipment of our sport.
So with a crew, would depending maybe on the ability or the size or the tallness, would the oars not be the same?
You can actually adjust them. So you can change the overall length, and you can change, it's a measurement called the spread, where you kind of move pieces of the boat around to complement people, because, there are some individuals that have longer legs or longer torsos than each other. So you can kind of specify within a boat to the individual, but that being said, you don't want to get too, too extreme, because that can be really hard to then match within a boat.
Yeah. Paula in Green Bay, we'll go to you next. Hi, Paula.
Oh, good afternoon. And Vicki, it's such a pleasure to hear this interview with you and Larry. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Wisconsin, UW-Wisconsin, and all the coaches and the legacy that the program has in Wisconsin, because, you know, people may not realize this, but there are quite a few clubs in Wisconsin. There's one in Green Bay. There's one in Appleton, Milwaukee. There are people who have boats elsewhere throughout the state. You know, rowing is a bigger deal than people realize here in the state. And it's because of people, you know, it's because of the Wisconsin system. And I just wanted to say thank you because of that. I also love that you gave a shout out to Masters Rowing. You know, because, you know, I think when we look at the Olympics, we look at these people and it's like, well, you know, I'm 30. There's no hope. But you know what? There's a lot of hope. I started rowing with the club here in Green Bay. I learned to row because my husband was a rower in college. Oh. I've competed on the master's level, both in nationally and internationally. And it's really cool what's happening with rowing now with coastal rowing. You mm-hmm. mentioned that. And another thing that's out there is that my husband and I have recently started doing is they have a mechanism that you can strap on a stand-up paddle board, and you use rowing oars, you know, sculling oars, to go out and scull. And that's just given for us, our rowing, a whole new aspect because we can go on water where you wouldn't dare take one of these skinny, delicate, you know, sculling shells because it would die immediately on a rock. And, you know, we've been able to go. We've been out on Green Bay. We've been up in the Michikanee Flowage. We've been to North Dakota. We've been in Minnesota. And so I would just want to say, you know, people, if you're interested, take a look around. There are ways to get into rowing. All these clubs probably have, I know our club does, we have learn to row programs. Give it a try. Give it a try. It's just been a wonderful, wonderful thing that we've done. And all I can say is, oh, I can't wait to see this U.S. Women's Eight. Go USA.
Thank you.
Paula, thanks a lot for calling. Well, that's a pretty nice comment.
Oh my gosh. No, that was fabulous. And it's also so tremendously rewarding to hear someone again, you know, later to life in the sport, have such a passion for it. And I think that's beautiful, truly.
Thanks again for that call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or experience to share. Somebody else wonders, does it change how you train if you have one oar versus two oars?
Ooh, another great question. I would say no. It changes only in, you know, the respect to the boat class. The motion is still quite similar. The mechanics are still quite similar. The speeds that you are trying to go are pretty close. I would argue, and maybe this is an unpopular opinion, I think it is more difficult to scull because you have an oar in each hand. And those boats typically tend to go a little bit faster just because you are able to accelerate more speed with two oars. But, you know, both sides of the sport, sweep and scull, really complement each other. And they're both uniquely challenging and rewarding.
How did you get involved in this sport?
A little bit of family history, I have to be honest. My grandfather was a coach here for many years here at Wisconsin. And my parents both rowed when they were in college here at Wisconsin. And I had always grown up hearing that it was an amazing sport and you meet some of the best friends of your life doing it, which I can honestly say is true. But I myself did not pick up the oar until I walked onto campus here in college. I was a tennis, soccer, and basketball player. And I like to joke that I still haven't gotten around to quitting, but absolutely fell in love with it. It is a sport that really rewards hard work. It's a direct correlation between the amount of, you know, effort you put into it and time. You see a lot of success. And it's tremendous. It really is.
Sue in northern Wisconsin has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say this is the best sport this university sponsors. I'm so fired up that we're talking about the Olympics again. Here's my quick question, because I know you have a lot of people that want to contact you. When I started in 79, there was a group of women who tried to get our own locker room, and they threatened to go to, or they actually did, I'm not sure, go to the athletic director's office and take their clothes off and kind of make a protest. And it worked. We still had half of the locker room in the old boathouse, but it's just amazing how far we've come for the women's program.
Yeah. Sue, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
So, yeah, that's what it was like.
Oh, yes.
In the 70s.
Yes. I mean, those
earlier.
Those women, I mean, we would not be here without them. Truly, they started and continue to support us, quite honestly, in all that we are trying to achieve. And it's it makes my job so enjoyable and rewarding to see these women that have come before myself and, you know, are so passionate about, you know, not only the sport, but also Wisconsin rowing, and to have them be role models, quite honestly, to today's athletes, I think is fabulous.
Let's say, you know, talk about facilities a little bit more, because the Porter Boathouse replaced that old boathouse that Sue was talking about, and it is quite a difference. Explain what that boathouse is like.
Yeah, no, we are tremendously lucky and fortunate here at Wisconsin. Our boathouse is on campus, which is actually quite unusual. There's a number of teams, a lot of teams around the country, where they actually have to travel to their boathouse and their facilities. So if you can imagine, you know, our practice already starts at 6 a.m. If you as a young student athlete had to, let's say, get up in the fours to drive 20, 30, 40 minutes one way to your practice and then back, that adds another whole, you know, challenge to the sport. But Porter Boathouse is actually here on campus. It's an amazing facility. We, you know, three teams use it. If you can kind of picture it, you know, you walk in the front door, you have an amazing community space with trophies of, you know, all of our historical memorabilia, wonderful, you know, coaches' offices that look right out onto the lake, locker rooms. And then you go upstairs, we have a weightlifting gym. We have three erg bays where we do a lot of our land training, stretching if we bring in, you know, people to come talk to us within the athletic department. And then if you go all the way downstairs, we have, oh gosh, at least five bays full of boats. And we're talking, you know, floor to ceiling. We are tremendously lucky that we've had a lot of good support over the years to be able to have a fairly good fleet. And it's an amazing facility. We're very lucky to have it.
I was remembering back, I think at the time there was some concern about the positioning of the boathouse because it was right along the lakeshore walkway.
Yes. You know, I hope we don't make too many people mad. We do have gates we like to drop when we're launching in the mornings. And, you know, at least in our minds as the coaches, it's just an extra probably 100 feet that people kind of have to reroute to go around the boathouse. It doesn't cut off their running path. We have made a couple of bikers a little unhappy with us. But it's really great for our student athletes because the accessibility, again, is, you know, amazing. But also if they want to go on a cross train run, they have Lakeshore Path right there. A lot of our athletes, maybe after a hard training session, like to go to the Union, grab a brat. You know, it's a win for us and we really like it.
And those and back to the bays, that I was trying to remember the number. There's several hundred boats held there, aren't there? There's 200 or 300?
There's a lot. We have to have, you know, one of the biggest fleets definitely in the country. And, you know, again, that's partly because historically we've had a long program here at Wisconsin. You know, but that being said, there's kind of a little bit of a shelf life of equipment. So we, you know, we are always looking to replace our boats for, you know, some of the newer models. And but it's also nice to have equipment for our novice athletes that are learning to row and maybe aren't as savvy in how to take the boat out of the water. So we let them use some of our older equipment that if it gets a little banged up, we aren't too upset. But yeah, no, we're very fortunate.
You know, as someone who's kayaked quite a bit, you know, just in a kayak, which is actually wider, I think, than a crew boat. And I've never been in a crew boat, but I thought to myself, I don't think I could stay up in the darn thing. I mean, they've got to be really tippy, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They are quite tippy. We actually we have like a summer development camp going on right now. And one of our student athletes was her first time in the single. So a single is a one person boat. And that probably from side to side where you actually sit in the boat is maybe 18 inches wide. Maybe.
Yeah.
So you are, you know, and then you're trying to balance, and there's a point in the rowing stroke where you don't have any, you know, support. You're trying to be as aerodynamic as possible. So you're trying not to touch the water because that creates drag. So there's definitely a lot of stability you have to practice. And that's why a lot of rowers have very good core strength, because you need to be able to really balance without falling over in the boat.
Yeah, I guess I would not be able to. I would have a hard time with it. Although I guess time in a kayak is helpful enough.
Oh yeah, oh yeah,
for sure. Well, let's talk about the Olympics. You've been involved in the Olympics yourself. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your experiences with the Olympics.
Absolutely. I've trained with the national team for about a decade, had wonderful experiences. I was a member of the Rio team and the Tokyo team. So some very interesting challenges, but also very rewarding experiences at the same time. So each Olympics, it's such an amazing experience. And I can say it's very different being an athlete there than being a spectator on TV. Certainly the athlete behind the scenes experience is it's so cool. Everything from the amount of publicity that you get to, you know, enjoy as being celebrated for your sport, to before you even get to the games, there's this event called processing. And that's where you get fitted with all the gear. You get media trained. You see, you know, other athlete celebrities that you're used to seeing on television just walking through the halls. And then you get to the village, and that's amazing too. It's basically, you know, an apartment complex of some of, you know, the most fit people in the world all walking around. And, you know, it's just, it's wild to, you know, be on your way walking to the dining hall in the games, and you see, you know, professional speed walkers just out for their walk. Or, you know, at Tokyo, it was the first time they had skateboarding. So you just see people skateboarding to the dining hall. And it's just, it's the most surreal experience, because, you know, every single person there is the top of their, you know, their class and their sport, but yet they're just normal people enjoying and loving what they do.
And you've been a world champion. Are the world championships different from the Olympics in terms of that atmosphere? No,
that's a great question. So in elite rowing at kind of the Team USA level, there is world championships every year that there is not an Olympic Games. So in a Olympic cycle, there are three world championships that lead up to the Olympic Games. Okay. So it's basically the exact same thing, except it's just not called the Olympics. Mm-hmm. But the year before the Games is very important. That's the qualifying world championship. So that's very stressful. You need to qualify to make sure you get into the Games. So not everybody gets an automatic bid to be a rower in the Games. It's very selective, and it's pretty cutthroat.
So, what makes those women successful rowers?
Ooh, that's a fantastic question. So knowing our four women that are going to be representing, you know, at the games this summer, I can say, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is their incredible work ethic. I think rowers are the people that tend to, you know, gravitate towards rowing as a sport. We like to say know how to grind. They just put their heads down. They work hard. They're not afraid to fail. I think that's also a really important characteristic is rowing is tough. It's not for the faint, and you can't always win. So you have to be willing to fail hard, fail often, but also know how to pick yourself up and keep on going and pushing for more.
Jeff wonders how prevalent are rowing teams in college athletics? It seems like you know, being on a lake gives us a bit of an advantage over many, but how about that? How prevalent is the sport?
Ooh, I don't know if I could give you like hardcore numbers or percentages. I mean, I can tell you that there are quite, I mean, if you go to like the NCAA website for women's rowing, there's Oof, there's a lot of teams between Division One through Three. There's a lot of teams. And, you know, you think about just, you know, our numbers is probably one of the larger squads, but you have some D3 schools that are probably, you know, 20 to 30 athletes on each team. So, you know, and I would wager at least at 100 schools around the country. That's a pretty large population just in terms of like varsity open weight women rowers.
Dawn emailed us. She says she's noticed that rowing crews don't face the finish line when while they race. It's behind their back. How does that change your mentality? And are you looking around at the boats that may or may not be passing them?
That's another great question. It is a funny sport that we do not face the finish line. That is absolutely correct. When you race, you do, you're in lanes. So you do have these sort of, you know, periphery visual cues that you can kind of know where you are. And there's usually lane markers on land that tells you the distance, how many meters into the race you're going. Typically, you try not to look around too much just because that can kind of disrupt the flow of the boat and it actually can break your concentration. But kind of, I would say a lot of rowers' mantra is to get ahead and stay ahead, and then you can see your competition coming at you. So,
Vicki Opitz, head coach at the UW-Madison women's rowing team. It's great to have her with us. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Having some fun today talking about women's rowing and the UW women's rowing team in particular. We're talking about the Olympics, too, and when it comes to rowing with our guest, Vicki Opitz, head coach of the UW-Madison's women's rowing team. And again, join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Rowing events are divided into what? Two categories, sculling and sweep rowing.
Correct.
What's the difference there?
The difference is just the amount of oars an athlete has in their hand. So sweep, you know, I guess if you could imagine you're sweeping a broom in your kitchen, you usually have one, you know, piece of wood and you're holding on to it with both hands. And sculling is one oar in each hand. So two oars in sculling per person.
And how are the I'm trying to think of the proper words. What so how are the categories then divided up? So talk a bit about that.
Yep. So in sweep rowing, which is one oar per athlete, you have the boat class categories of an 8, a 4, and a pair. So that's a two-person boat, a four-person boat, and a, well, a nine-person boat with a coxswain. And then in sculling, the boat class categories are a single. So that's one person, two oars, a double, two people, two oars, and a quad. So that's four people with two oars. So not a an octuple that has, you know, many oars, but they're very similar in terms of the amount of people in the boats. It's just strictly the oars.
Mary in Fish Creek has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I am just enjoying your show so much. I'm glad I tuned it in the middle. I used to be on the Duluth Rowing Club, as did, it was an 8. We did some 4s, and my friend Kathy Bussett was on our team and actually went to Madison then and was on their team. And then we had Joey Krumpetich that went to the Olympics.
Well, and while you were talking there, Mary, I saw Vicky's head nodding. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I had the pleasure of racing when I was in college at the Duluth International Regatta up there, and it was beautiful. And some of those trophies were probably some of the most beautiful rowing trophies I have ever seen. And it's just gorgeous up there.
Yeah. Mary, thanks very much for calling. I'm glad you were doing it. Al in Grant County, we'll go to you. Hi, Al.
Good afternoon. See, I just turned into your program, and I was curious, when you're matching up a team, a rowing team, do you have to match the stature and physical abilities of the ladies, or can they be just be a mixture of heights and strength?
Yeah. Well, I know they tend to be tall.
That does help. The amount of leverage that you can, you know, kind of use with your limbs is definitely beneficial. But I'll also be the first one to tell you, it's in our sport, it is truly the fight of the, you know, or the amount of fight in the dog. I have rode with some women, you know, personally that are 5'5", 5'6". And they are fierce and they will not back down, especially if they're competing against an athlete that's 6'4". They don't care. So, again, our sport, if you have the determination, it can oftentimes override the physical attributes.
Although I must say, one of my students, one of my advisees was a rower, and she got married. I was invited to the wedding and the reception, and the reception, there were a lot of UW rowers involved in this. And so I'm looking at this, and they all look like about the height of a basketball player, both the men and the women, for sure. I also had a friend when I was starting college here, actually, as a freshman. I had a friend who was short, kind of light, and in the lines at the time, he was approached by the crew about maybe being a coxswain.
Yes. Yes, those are tremendously important positions. And that, I think, is the, you know, kind of fascinating dichotomy of our sport, is you try to get these, you know, typically very tall, strong, large muscled individuals. But then you also go for these, you know, usually smaller, more petite individuals that are the ones that steer the bigger boats and yell out the commands. So you need to also be feisty in the coxswain seat. And it's really fantastic. Our lightweight head coach is a former coxswain, and it's been awesome, you know, listening to him, you know, try to give his knowledge on how to be a better coxswain. And one of our amazing volunteer coaches, Chris Leyland, has also been a coxswain. So they have a unique perspective that they're able to be in the boats with the athletes, give them feedback, but not be the ones doing the physical task. So you definitely need those smaller individuals in the boathouse, and we wouldn't be a complete team without them.
So there's got to be you got to be part psychologist, don't you, when you're a coxswain? I'm thinking back to the movie, The Boys in the Boat. It apparently does make a big difference, the ability of the coxswain.
Oh, yes. It is definitely an exercise in learning how to get the most out of your athletes, both as a coxswain and as a coach. You know, and it's very similar, I would imagine, you know, if, you know, just thinking of my own career playing tennis, like, you need to learn, you know, what kind of motivates people and what's going to, when it's, you know, you're going bow ball to bow ball with a boat, yeah. And, you know, it's kind of the heat of battle, if you will, out there. You have to be very clued in into what's going to make your crew go and push past any pain that they're feeling.
Bart emailed, you've mentioned lightweight and heavyweight, I guess. Bart wonders, what's the difference between regular rowing and lightweight rowing?
Great question. So in our sport, we have just a small kind of weight class division. So for female athletes, we typically lightweights are 130 pounds and under. That's their race requirement at the collegiate level. And then open weight, heavyweight is anything above that. And there's no difference other than just kind of the weight aspect of it. And same thing with men's rowing. There's a heavy class or heavyweight division and also a lightweight men's division. And I believe, and someone's going to have to fact check me on this, but I believe men is 160 pounds for a lightweight man, I think, and under.
And someone else wonders, how much time does a student spend in practice, when you add up practicing and competing and so forth?
Well, as their coach, I would love to have them forever. But no, we typically it's 20 hours a week in required practice time. And that it is like a full-time job. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Especially in this day and age, it's you have to be consistent in your training. There's not a lot of flexibility. And it's really tough because it's a balance of, you know, especially being a student athlete, obviously mm-hmm. your studies are always going to be first, but you know, that you have those athletes as well that want to keep pushing and getting better and better and better. So you have to kind of navigate those waters and to make sure that they are, you know, staying healthy, getting as much rest, because that's also really important. So it's a lot of training. It's a sport that requires a lot of hours of getting better for a very short 6-minute race.
Yeah, for a very short race, it's many hours. What about in terms of staffing on your side? Mm-hmm. You certainly have medical people and trainers.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, it's truly, I am a small piece of this amazing team. You know, you have everything from the coaching staff to our director of operations to, you know, Coach Clark, who is our director of rowing, to our sports medicine, sports psych, our nutritionists, our, you know, our lifting coach, our boatmen, you know, the administration. I mean, it's a full team behind the team, and it's I could not be more pleased to work with my coworkers, and our volunteer staff too are incredible.
And nutrition help as well?
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, they I'm always very jealous, because when I was in college, we did not have athlete lunch. And that's one of the perks of now being a student athlete here. And it's good food. And especially as rowers, you got to eat a lot. So it's exciting.
Sue in northern Wisconsin wonders about seat races. Mm. And do you still throw the cocks in the water if you win?
Those are great questions. So, yes, we definitely do still use seat racing. Typically, that's between two athletes that over the course of the year have been pretty close in their results. So that's reserved for kind of a last kind of final say in who gets a spot in a boat, a seat race. And then, I'm so sorry, could you mind what the last part of that question was?
Do you throw the cocks in the water?
We do, yes. You know, typically we do check that the water is safe and clean before we toss them in, but that is absolutely still part of our sport and one that we love to celebrate.
And a listener emailed wondering, are there rowing camps or classes for youth?
Yes. Yes, here at Madison, we do have youth rowing camps and clinics. So our next one is, I believe, in middle of July. And they're about 4 days of, you know, it's everything that you could ever want to learn about the sport. You're taught by, you know, UW coaches that, you know, step in and, you know, give little hour seminars here and there. You get to be in a boat. It's a fantastic way if you're a youngster that's looking to check out rowing.
So how do you sign up for those?
I believe if you go to uwbadgers.com and you click on our sport tab, which is women's rowing, there should be a tab that says camps, and you just follow that link and sign up.
And a small cost connected with it, I assume.
Correct, yes. Yeah.
And Sue is also wondering, what's your prediction for the Olympics? How the U.S. is going to do in rowing?
Sue, you're putting me on the spot. The one thing that I think people should know about the games, and specifically with rowing, is it's so hard to predict. I mean, you have people that, you know, have trained the last 3.9 years for this one event. And everything can affect it, you know, how you sleep, how you eat at that level, to if there's any sort of, you know, equipment malfunction in the race. For our Badgers that are competing, I think they have a serious shot at the podium. I really do. But that also being said, it's going to be very difficult just because the level of rowing globally has risen so much. So it's going to be some exciting racing, and I hope people tune in to watch our Badgers compete.
I will, for sure, and I bet a lot of our listeners will, too. Vicki, thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
Thank you.
To talk with you, and down the road we can do this again. Vicki Opitz, head coach of the UW-Madison women's rowing team. It's great to have her with us and learn more about what's going on in the rowing community. And I want to thank you for joining us today. This and all of our shows are a team effort. Producers Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News. Stay with us.